Hello, everybody. I'm Phil Margavichis, and welcome to another episode of the Project MedTech Podcast. If you need anything from us or would like to suggest a future guest, you can email us at info@projectmedtech.com. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe and leave a review. For more information on Project MedTech and to sign up for our monthly newsletter, visit our website at www.projectmedtech.com and follow us on LinkedIn. If you are enjoying this content, don't forget to check out our other podcasts by searching Funding MedTech on your favorite podcast platform or by heading to our website. Funding MedTech is an interview-style podcast focused on exploring ways to fund MedTech innovation and will be released weekly on Wednesdays. This episode of the podcast is brought to you by Sleeman & Lund. Sleeman & Lund is a leading intellectual property boutique specializing in medical devices. They become a trusted partner for inventors, startups, and industry giants alike. Founded by seasoned attorneys with decades of experience, Sleeman & Lund combines experience with innovation. When it comes to protecting your groundbreaking medical device inventions, Sleeman & Lund stands at the forefront, offering expert legal counsel and strategic guidance that can make all the difference. Whether you're a passionate inventor with a game-changing idea or a company seeking to safeguard your innovations, Sleeman & Lund has the expertise and experience you need to navigate the complex world of medical device patents. In this episode, Anish Kaushal of Amplitude Ventures and Dwayne Mancini discuss his background in the medtech space, his transition from being a medical doctor to venture capitalist, and his new book, and so much more.
Okay, Anish, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much. Really excited to be here and excited to have this conversation.
Yeah, so Anish, we've been talking for a long time. You've actually been on Project MedTech's MedTech Money series in the past to talk about what you do with Amplitude Ventures. Today, this conversation's a little different. It's about you and your unique transition to your current role in the venture capital world, because I think you're a medical doctor by training. And so we'll kind of get into your background here. So much so that you wrote a book about it. And so we'll dive into that here in a second as well. But for the listeners who, for people listening in, background to who you are, your background, and what you currently do.
Yeah, absolutely. So first of all, thank you so much for the opportunity. Super excited to be here. And Dwayne, you and I have known each other for a few years, so it's great to always chat and always get to connect like this. Happy to kind of go through my background and maybe elongate the story a little bit to kind of provide context for people who don't know me. Name's Anish, sort of Canadian at heart. Grew up to sort of immigrant parents, both from India in Toronto, so just outside of Toronto in Canada. So spent my entire life here, grew up here, was grown up in a suburb of the city. And then as I was finishing high school, ended up applying to medicine. So I got into medical school abroad. And so at the age of 17, I moved to Scotland in the UK to go study medicine. So went right out of high school, avoided all of the traditional North American kind of undergrad into medical school, MCAT, studying interviews, all of that stuff. And I just went kind of right in out of high school. So I moved to Scotland. I moved to the University of St. Andrews. People know that is famous for either golf or where Prince Will and Kate actually met. So it's known as a Royal University or also the Golfers University. So spent definitely many hours on a golf course while I was there, but also tried to study as much as I could while doing the same thing.
So you are a golfer, Anish.
I am a golfer. I am a very big golfer. I'm a huge golfer.
Oh.
So yes.
Wow.
Yeah.
We've known each other for years, and
I
very much enjoy golfing as well. So.
Oh, amazing. Did not know that. Okay, yeah.
We
have to, exactly. I was going to say the best round up till, I think it was this year or a couple of years ago, I shot 79 on the old course, and that was my, gung-ho. Like, I couldn't believe it. So got a par on the road hole. Like, it was just the best experience ever. Moved to Scotland. I went to study medicine there. Awesome experience. That was 3 years I spent at St. Andrews, and then for my clinical degree, I spent it in Edinburgh, to another big city, the biggest city in the capital of Scotland. So moved there for 3 years. And then during that time, I also did a bunch of electives in Canada. So I spent time in hospitals in Canada, working, doing clinical rotations here at the U of A at Edmonton. And so I got a good perspective of what medicine was like in the UK, but also here in Canada, what it was like to work as a doctor. And essentially, when I was doing that, I kind of got fell out of love, if that makes sense, sort of with medicine, in terms of, I just kind of realized that it wasn't the be all end all that I thought it was going to be. I found medicine very administrative, very bureaucratic, very narrow minded and focused. And also, it didn't feel like, why you got in to help patients was really the driver of your job and what you do. It was really just dealing with a lot of other stuff. And then at that time, also, like I was applying to residency jobs back in Canada. And for any international person who's gone to a medical school abroad, it's very tough to get in. And so that was sort of my genesis for kind of like, okay, can I explore other options outside of medicine? And so I started talking to folks actually outside the industry. I was very fortunate to have a dad who worked in finance, so he connected me with some people in the consulting and banking industry. I spoke to both of them, and they said like, "Hey, that's cool. You have a good background, but like, you should finish your residency before you come out." And at that point, I was like, not sure about that, just because I was like, "Why would I spend more time in medicine if I don't really have to?" But I thought it was reasonable advice, and honestly, I would give that advice to some people if they talked to me today and they were in residency. So I totally get why they where they're coming from. But essentially, I was studying for finals. This is my final year. I was like, okay, this is not it. Like, and this is the time also I found out I wasn't going to get a job in Canada. So I was essentially a year out. I couldn't, like, I had this medical degree I finished with, but like, I couldn't start working in Canada for a year. And so in that year off, I was like, okay, you know what? Like, I'm not happy with this. Like, let me see if I can try and leave. And if not, then, a year from now, I'll go back to medicine. Like, no problem. So I talked to my parents. They said, yeah, that's fine. So I was actually thinking about going back to school. So my plan was to go to a 1 year master's degree in the UK, is in London at a School of Drug Discovery and Pharma Management at UCL. And I had a friend who did the program, so I went down to visit her and talk to the program director, and it sounded perfect. Like, basically, you spend a year learning about drug discovery and pharma. They have a 95% graduation rate into jobs. And a lot of people work in the pharma industry in Europe. I was like, perfect. This is exactly what I want. This sounds perfect. I'm going to do that. So I got in. This was probably like July 2018, and the program started in October. So basically, I was off for the summer. I was like, okay. So I was at home. I was like hanging out, playing a lot of golf, actually. That was when basically I kept applying to jobs. So I kept reaching out to people. I tried kind of trying to find jobs on LinkedIn and online, and I got rejected from all of them. So I think I probably sent in, I don't know, 75 applications, 50 to 75, and like no, nothing, crickets all the time. And I still kept talking to people, still kept reaching out, still kept doing everything I could. And then essentially August, so this was maybe about 6 weeks before I was about to start, my dad's like, "Have you heard of venture capital?" And I was like, "What is a venture capital? I've never heard of this before. What is this idea? How does this work?" Never, literally knew nothing about it. The only context I had was there's a show on HBO called Silicon Valley that some people might have heard of and seen before. So that show in the tech world is literally the only context I had. I was like, "So in tech, right? Like that's what it means." And he was like, "No, they do the same thing in healthcare." I was like, did not know that. Like, literally no idea, never heard that in school, and nobody ever talked to me about that. Didn't know that was a thing. So basically what happened was one Sunday in August, I just looked up the top 75 VC firms in healthcare around the world, and I just cold emailed them. I said, "Hey, my name's Anish. Like, I would love to talk to you if you're open to it. Here's like my background." And as you can imagine, a lot of people don't respond because, that's how the world works. But a few people did. And I was really grateful that some people wrote me emails, some people got on the phone with me. And one person actually said, "Hey, we have an internship program. Are you interested?" And I was like, "Absolutely." But, I'd been rejected from many jobs up to this point. So I was like, okay, well, there's no way I'm getting in here. But sure, yes, absolutely, I'm interested. So I went through three rounds of interviews with them. And then 2 days before I was about to move to London, which is where I was going to do the master's, they said, "Yeah, we really like you. We'll see you in Amsterdam." So as you can imagine, life changes very quickly. 2 weeks later, I got on a plane and moved to Amsterdam. Didn't know anyone, or I actually knew one person through a friend of mine. That was about it. But yeah, moved to and worked at a place called M Ventures. So it was a corporate venture fund of Merck, or EMD Serono, as it's known in the US, basically a really large pharma company. So I worked for their corporate VC fund on their therapeutics team, which at the time they were running a $250 million US fund that was evergreen. So, got to see some really cool science and ideas. And so that was my first intro to venture. And I would say like a month in was when I realized like, oh, this is actually really cool. Because I'll never forget, like, I woke up one day, this was like literally a month into the job. I woke up before my alarm, and I woke up like excited and happy to go to work. And I never once felt that in medicine. Medicine always felt like a bit of a drag. They love like, yeah, I got to do this. I don't really like this, but like, I got to do it, whatever. But this, I was like excited. And I was like, oh, this is something. Like, the fact that I have this feeling is, I think, a really good thing and tells me that this is the right path, or at least I should try and pursue this as long as I can. So essentially a couple months will go by, and halfway through the internship, they're like, hey, we like you, but we can't keep you. We don't have a job. And so I talked to my parents at this point. They're like, hey, you should go back to medicine. And I was like, what are you talking about? Like, I'm out of medicine now. Like, I don't want to go back. Like, there's no way I'm going to go back. And so I told them in my head, I was like, you know, there's no way. Like, I will do everything I can to make sure I don't go back to medicine. So I spoke to 100 VCs over the next 3 months, cold email network, reached out, asked for intros, LinkedIn, everything. Had so many conversations with tons of folks, and then got to a point where I basically got three final round interviews, one with a firm in Germany, one with a firm in SF, and then one with a firm in Canada. And the firm in Canada, I was like, okay, this is a really cool opportunity. It was just starting at the beginning. You get to come home to build something that, you know, especially having been in Europe at that point for 7 years, I was like, you know, if I could come home and do something, that would be really cool. So I joined Amplitude Ventures when they just started back in 2019. Joined the team in Montreal when we hadn't raised any money, and, you know, started there. COVID happened, so then ended up moving back home to Toronto and kind of been here ever since. So that's a bit about my journey. And then in terms of Amplitude, just kind of high level, like, you know, we started when we were zero. Now we're managing almost $500 million. It's one of the largest biotech healthcare funds in their country. And so it's been really cool to be a part of the journey, because I remember being at the beginning and starting processes and setting things up and doing all of that. And now at the stage where, you know, we have a lot more capital than we did then. And it's been super cool to be able to employ that, invest that, and also just be a part of the ecosystem for a really long time. So yeah, that's kind of a bit of the journey, but yeah, happy to answer specific questions and dig into anything more.
Yeah, super cool. This is really interesting. So I guess working my way from the beginning of your story mm-hmm. back here.
Yeah.
So grew up in Toronto. Are you a Blue Jays fan?
I am a Blue Jays fan, yes. Okay. Sadly, I'm all a Toronto sports fan. Raptors, I would say the highest, and, you know, my life is now happy that they won. Like, I can die happy forever because of that title. The Blue Jays is another story, and the Shohei news, as you can imagine, over the weekend was its own interesting saga. But yes, I am a Blue Jays fan, absolutely.
Yeah, awesome. Yeah. Very cool.
Yeah.
The Scotland thing's fascinating. For those people who don't know golf, the fact that Anish shot a 79 on the old course is incredible. So that's super cool. Super cool. You got to play that. My cousins and uncle and some of their friends actually just went over to Scotland for a tour.
Oh, awesome.
And, you know, got to play a bunch of courses and stuff like that.
So yeah, it's the best.
Yeah, really cool. So, you know, the falling out of love with medicine piece, you know, this is something that if you're close to physicians and or people going through medical school, this happens frequently. And it's
agreed.
You know, it's a weird spot to be in for these folks, because you're trying to figure out you're going through school, you're trying to figure out what's next. And oftentimes, you know, what you described, I'd like to take it one step further and maybe expand upon the dilemma here, which is you know, medical school is expensive. And so,
yeah, it is very expensive.
Yeah, as you start to get into this, I can't help but imagine you almost feel stuck, because are you gonna not do this and have a load of debt? I mean, can you kind of break down that dilemma a little bit as well? That just from people you might know, yourself, that kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I think to your point, I think the sunk cost fallacy that I think a lot of people go through and think about as they go through medicine is a real thing. And I think a lot of people feel like once they're in that they're kind of trapped and that there's really nothing they can do and nothing else. And the point of kind of the story and, you know, honestly writing the book and doing all the things I'm doing is to say to people like, hey, you're not, like, just because you're in that situation doesn't mean you can't get out of it. Doesn't mean that there's a way out. Because honestly, I was the same point. Like I thought that was it. I thought there was nothing else. I thought that's all I could do. In terms of, to your point, the sort of cost, medicine is very expensive. In Touchwood, I was very fortunate. Like, I got a lot of support from my parents, and that's honestly the biggest reason why I ended up being there in Scotland. At the same time, I did have to take on student debt. That was definitely part of it. That was I knew that going in. And that was something that, you know, I still have to think about and deal with even today. But to me, at the same time, it was one of those things where I knew in my life that, like, and again, maybe it sounds trite, maybe it sounds like I learned this before, but I was like, I knew my happiness and what I wanted to work on felt significant to me. And that I needed, that matter to me, because I wanted to choose that, like, at a young age, if I could find something that I liked, as hard as it was, that would make me happier going forward rather than like sticking out through what I don't. And I think to your point, the trouble that some people might have when they're in medicine is like, let's say you take on a couple, like 100 plus grand in student debt. And you're like, well, I need to pay this off. And so a lot of people get into, you know, they're like, well, I have to go and I have to do all. So first thing I would say is if you don't have to take on debt, don't take on debt, because that's, you know, that's sort of the first thing. Actually, to Mark Ruffalo sort of interview recently, it was on Hot Ones, and he was saying like, as an actor, what would you advise? He's like, number one, stay out of debt. And I was like, that's great advice for anyone in general. So I was like, that's true. But like if you are in that situation, one, it's not the end of the world. That's okay. Two, like if you get into areas like myself, sometimes you do have to take a like manufactured or idea step back in terms of like, you know, earning potential, because especially as a resident, like for example, as a resident, you're earning, let's say, I'm just going to use Canadian numbers, but I imagine the US is pretty similar. But like, let's say as a resident, you're earning 60 to 80 grand. And then once you become an attending, so like a full consultant or full specialist, you start earning 250 plus, 300 plus, right? So by the time you're earning that amount of money, you can pay off student debt reasonably easily, right? So which is why a lot of people take it on, which is why a lot of, you know, people are willing to like government, like, you know, financial institutions are willing to give it, because they know like doctors will have that. And I think the thing I try to explain to people is like, in this business, what I appreciate about this, which is also a risk to some people because they don't like it, is like you get to make your career. So like my career theoretically has exponential potential because I can decide to go any which way based on what I'm doing. And I can tell you, like if you're doing really well at a biotech company or at a venture capital firm or at a big firm, you can earn a lot and you can do much better than and most doctors are doing as well. Also with the caveat of you have ownership and equity in businesses, and those businesses, if they do well over time, earn you more money than anything that you would do earning while you're working as a physician. And so to me, I think the reason I took that was more the bet on myself of like, do I believe that my earning potential long-term is higher in this business than it would be in medicine? And the answer to me was, yeah, it is. Now that I don't think that's true for everyone. I think there's a lot of people that like stability. And there's a lot of people that like where they are and are happy, and that's totally fine. And I would never take that away from them. But I'm the kind of person that like, and you know, we and I have known each other for years, like I'm always working to something. I'm always like operating. I'm always learning. I'm always trying to figure out the next thing. Because to me, I just see like my potential as really infinite. And I found that in medicine, your potential is not infinite. Like, you know, I've had a few friends who have graduated now as specialists. Like I have a few friends who are family doctors. Even my, my brother is now a full family doctor. And essentially his earning potential, the moment he graduates till the moment he retires, is the exact same. There's no upwards, and that's great. And you're doing really well. And I would never take that away because doctors do awesome. But if you don't like the grind of being a doctor, which is hard in general for anybody that knows anybody who's a physician, it can really eat at you. And to me, I think my thing was like, could I find a job or career where it doesn't have to eat at me? I could still do well on a longer term basis. I'm not going to make that amount of money up front, but that I'm really happy about it and I feel like I'm driving something. So hopefully that answers a bit of the question. I don't know if it totally did, yeah. But that's kind of the way I thought about it.
Yeah, it does. I mean, something I thought about for a long time, right? Because like, you know, if you express interest in, and at least, you know, so I'm 33, right? So I graduated high school in 2008. When I graduated high school, if I expressed an interest in the sciences, you know, it was, well, go be a pharmacist or go be a nurse or go be a doctor, or, you know, it's something clinician oriented. And, you know, there's a lot of people who are like, oh, well, more people are leaving those. I don't think there's any less interest in necessarily being a doctor anymore. I just think we did a really lousy job of letting people know that there's an alternative to,
agreed,
you know, affecting people's lives. And we all have the same mission. It's like, yeah, we want to go save lives, affect lives in a positive way. It's just, for me, it was never explained to me, at least in high school, and maybe even the first couple years of my study,
even university, right? Yeah,
that there's another option here. I find it really interesting because there's a lot of people I know who I think if it was 5-6 years before, they would have made the decision to not be a practicing clinician and get into something that we're doing, like what we're talking about here. And it's a shame because I think there are some financial constraints on why they may be making,
agreed,
that decision.
100%.
Yeah, yeah, so I find your story, you know, fascinating from that sense. And I also think too, what's demoralizing for a lot of folks is when you're in the high school area or when you're in high school or in your university, you know, you think that you may have a bigger influence than you do when you're a clinician.
Agreed.
Which again, 100%. Yeah, that stinks when it finally happens, that you kind of get out into the world and realize that hospitals, and
bureaucracy
and insurance
and insurance companies
make a lot of decisions. You know, I think
and limit you in many ways.
Yeah, yeah. There's a clip from one of our happy hours we used to do during COVID. It was a virtual happy hour, and Nick Anderson's his name, and he's a health economist and reimbursement expert, and he used to be at Intermountain Health.
Not familiar, but okay.
Yeah, yeah. It's kind of like in the Utah-ish area.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
And so he was a you know, a payer, an analyst.
Yeah.
He made a comment. He's like, you know, fundamentally, you have to understand that, at least in the U.S., we all pay a bunch of money into a pile over here, which is insurance, but we all consume our healthcare at these different, you know, hospitals, surgery centers, wherever you go, right? And he said the only mission of those hospital systems is to extract as much money from that pile as possible. And the insurance companies want to hold on to as much money. And I said, again, it is very crude and basic, and people can argue about it all they want. But he said, and
it's not lying.
The way these hospitals extract that money is clinicians. And, you know, when you
how else do they do it?
Yeah, when you simplify that, it's just it's interesting, right? Again, there's a plenty of room for debate on all of this, and is the world that cold? No, but again, at the basic level, you have to understand the economics of that.
Well, economics to me, and the other thing that I find so important around that is incentives. And I think to me, incentives, and again, RIP Charlie Munger, you know, man who just passed, like that guy I've learned, you know, eons and so many people I think around the world have, and he talks a lot about psychology. And I remember one thing to me that is cemented in my brain is incentives are superpowers. And if you can understand the incentives of how everybody operates in a system, you understand how the system works, in my opinion, right? To your point, we can argue, we can debate. And the thing that's happened, and what's really interesting is, so there's a guy called Peter Kolchinsky. I don't know if you're familiar. He runs a firm called RA Capital, and he's very involved politically in the pharma drug pricing debate. Because the way that the drug companies have lobbied the government is that, you know, pharma is making all the money because, you know, prices are too high, which, to be fair, not totally wrong. There are definitely some pharma companies that are price gouging and absolutely spending too much and, you know, hiking the cost of a drug that costs $5 to like $2,000. And you're like, okay, that makes no sense. Wholeheartedly believe and agree with that. But the thing that most people miss, and I think, again, lobbying incentives, all the things that you've discussed, is who has made the money. Because I remember there's a chart, and I'm going to have to send this to you because I think it might be interesting to see in the show notes, where you looked at, like, I remember seeing it was like the cost of a knee replacement. And it was in the like 1990s versus like today. And it's like the cost effectively, or what the hospital or physician made, is the same amount, right? But the number of insurance companies, providers, people, money, value, market cap of all of these has grown exponentially. And so to your point is, as a physician, your job fundamentally should be treating patients, but that's not how your job works, especially in the US. And I know that's an even different system than how I operate. Like, I have a few friends who I went to school with in the UK who are in the US, and I speak to them a lot. And I think when you're in the hospital, also depending on what type of specialty you're doing, like if, you know, you're doing GP versus obstetrics versus eMERGE, versus, like, there's, I think, a lot of nuance to each one of these. But I mean, even speaking to him and also knowing how the system works, just being in this business for a long time, like, who is making the money, right? And where are the incentives and who are they aligned? It's not the physician. The physician is doing the same job that they were doing 20 years ago. And it's the same, a lot of the same costs, a lot of the same input, a lot of the same stuff. But why are they so much more expensive? And who's making that money? And you can, it's not like, to me, I don't think it's rocket science, respectfully, right? And so I think, again, there's a lot of nuance, there's a lot of debate. We can argue about X, Y, and Z. And I'm sure there's going to be payers that come behind me and are like, ah, you're wrong. And that's fair. But to me, it's like, well, like, if you just look at, to me, basic math. And the other thing that I find so interesting about the US system, more just like broadly philosophical, is like America spends like double per the next country in the world per capita on healthcare. And they have some of the worst results amongst developed countries. And they have some of the sickest people in the world. And the other thing that I found recently, and I can share this with you too, is that like I just saw Washington Post did a recent massive article on like the declining mortality rate, and that people are now dying younger. And to me, that's more of a philosophical, like crazy America story generally that I think we can touch on, and that's too much for this conversation. But I think to me, what's interesting about that is like, again, as a physician, I think my realization was that yes, you can affect somebody's life at the point of care, which is like, you know, you and I have a conversation, I can prescribe you a drug, that drug, you know, saves you a little bit and you're happy. And that's really great. I found that in my life and in speaking to people who had done this career for a long time, because I did a lot of observerships, I have a lot of my parents' friends who are physicians as well, is that was not going to make you happy because over time you're doing the same thing. And to me, what I really appreciate about my job is like I get to invest in companies that one, my friends as physicians won't see for 10 years, but two, have the potential to actually change people's lives on a massive scale. And like we have an example of that of a drug company called Prolenia. We recently invested in a couple of years ago. They just got, you know, some good news, which is really nice. There's potential for them to get approved in Huntington's disease, and that's a condition with no treatment.
Right.
And so you look at that and you're like, there is literally hundreds of thousands of millions of people around the world affected by this disease, and you can invest in a drug that actually helps them and helps their families. That to me is like, I really like that because that's aligned. My incentives are very aligned. I only do well if they do well, and they only do well if they push patient outcomes in the right way. Again, I think it just goes back to the central point of like incentives are everything. If you can understand the incentives of any system, you understand it really well. And I just think healthcare in America is its own chaos. Yeah,
I agree. Anish, the incentive thing is literally, it's part of our sales pitch when we are talking to potential clients for Project MedTech, right? Because we don't compete against incubators, accelerators. We're kind of the next step after incubators and accelerators, but there's a lot of groups that there is a healthy amount of like overlap as well. And our point to them is, look, some of the accelerators that you join are, most of them are not for profits, right? That's pretty much what they are most of the time. There's some type of either, you know, some government funding, local, regional or federal coming in to help fund those things or sponsorships, those types of things. They will exist no matter if startup A, B, and C fail or not. Project MedTech, as a consulting company, if our companies fail, Project MedTech will not exist anymore. We fail, right? And so I kind of use that to tell them like our incentivized, we are perfectly incentivized for your success. It's just funny that you brought that up because we tell a lot of our startups that we're going to work with that our incentives are completely aligned, and that's why we will work well together, right? So I love that you brought that up. You know, you get interested in VC, you send out all the applications, you dodge the bullet with the 1 year's master program, right? And you get the internship at M Ventures, and then you end up joining Amplitude. How much of a, you know, you've kind of alluded to it a little bit here, but how much of a different like mentality, what were some of the similarities? Like, what are some of the things you pulled from your medical degree and now use in your new gig? Because like for me, right, I have a master's in medicinal chemistry. So I came from a scientific background, and now, you know, here I am in this role with Project MedTech. And I always tell people like the biggest thing that my thesis did for me was it gave me insight on how to solve a problem, right? Like that was one of the biggest things. And understand problems, right? And be able to look at it holistically and not in like a linear fashion, that sort of thing. So I'm curious for you, right? Like, again, you're not using your medical degree from a sense of you're actually practicing, but surely you must have taken a number of things from there. And besides the basics, right? Like, obviously, you can understand science, right? That's a no-brainer. But I'm curious about some of the other things. Yeah.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think, and again, this is the point that I always try to make, even within the book as well, which is like, we all have a lot of transferable skills that I think a lot of us don't realize that we do. Because when you learn what you're doing, you don't realize that that can be applied in many other industries and situations. And so, you know, the first thing to me is learning how to learn, That to me is the number one skill of any good VC. And I remember, I'll never forget the last interview I had with the people at M Ventures. My boss said, I said, what advice do you have for anybody? And I still burn in my brain. He's like, you need to learn how to learn. That is the number one skill of anybody. He's like, I can't tell you an answer to everything. I don't know everything. I'm not supposed to know everything, but I can get you an answer very quickly. And he's like, the best people that last in this business, in any business in general, is I can tell you an answer immediately. I know where to find it. I know how to get it. I know where it is. That to me is a skill that you can, like, you learn in medicine. I mean, and again, it sounds trite, but like, I always make fun of, like, you know, I was at a wedding recently with a bunch of friends from medical school who, you know, are all physicians. And we were making the joke about how, you know, we went to medical school, but all of us still look at Google to like find the answers to the problems that we're dealing with, right? And again, it sounds like kind of a kind of dumb, like kind of, you know, weird thing. But it's true in the sense of like, that's what it taught us. Like, if you don't know the answer, how do you figure out the answer as quickly, efficiently, make sense to what you're doing as possible? And so that's like a big skill on the VC side that I think is super important. I think to your point, the learning how to learn in the research side. So when I was in medical school, because of just the function of like me getting into residency at the time, I had to do a lot of research. So I did a lot of clinical research. I was in labs. I read papers. I was on PubMed. I was doing all the stuff that we were doing. I wrote papers. I did all of that. I never realized at the time that that was actually the skill most needed for me in my job as a VC. Because full transparency, I did not like research. I was not a fan of it. I did not enjoy it. I didn't go into it being like, this is great. I can't wait to do this. It was like, oh my God, why am I doing this? This is a terrible thing. I don't want to do this. And so again, but what I appreciate about that is like to tell people like sometimes those skills you don't think you need, and those opportunities that you do outside of what you're doing are actually the ones that are going to make the difference down the road. And so to me, that to me was like the number one. Like I remember being at Ventures, and again, I started from scratch. I had no background, no context, no training in anything that I was doing. And they're like, go read a bunch of papers on oncology and figure out and tell us if this is interesting science or not. And like, I didn't know how to do that, but I knew how to find answers to questions. And exactly what you say, to solve problems. And so I think to me, like fundamentally as a VC, those are the two things. I think as an investor over time, I don't know if medicine, I think what I appreciate about my time in medicine as well, which is I don't think for everyone, but for us in my training we got was communication skills. And I remember like formally the school that I went to, St. Andrews, we used to have communication classes, which again, sounds kind of dumb because you're like, well, what do you mean? Like everybody can communicate. Everybody can talk to each other. That's how it's supposed to work. But I really appreciate that they like took it to bare bones and was like, this is how you're supposed to speak to patients. This is what you're supposed to get from them. This is how you're supposed to talk to them. And because of that formal training, I still remember some of those things from when I was in school. And to me, it's like, even when talking to people, building relationships, you know, reaching out to folks like yourself and, you know, people that are in this business and I've been doing for a number of years, it's like, okay, how do you learn, like, you know, how do you help the other person across from you? Not how can, and I think this is the other thing. I mean, I mentioned this book, but I think it's like a fundamental thing of networking, which is, I think a lot of people go into networking or communication or relationships with how can I extract value out of this other person? And to me, that is the entirely wrong way to do it. It is how do I provide value to this person? Because to me, my thing is if I provide value to them, then they're going to provide value to me long-term. They will for sure, 100%, no question about it. So I don't know, that was more specific to my training in terms of medicine and in terms of kind of how it was. But like, I mean, there's a lot of people in medicine who are not very good communicators. I'm sure everybody's, you know, spoken to doctors who are like, this person sucks. And I definitely have too. So I don't think that's a universal thing. But in terms of my training specifically, that was another one. So, but again, to me, the number one thing was like the learning how to learn, learning how to pick up concepts. That was like, that can be applied in any arena and any domain for
yeah.
sure.
Yeah, 100%. So the providing value piece, the networking piece, boy, this is just spot on, right? So when we started Project MedTech, and so I guess, you know, I have two of the co-founders, Aaron Tenhusen and Rich Mazzola, but when I before they had become involved, part of this was, and you could ask both of them, they'll tell you the same pitch I gave them to have them join the team, which was, you know, with the podcast, everybody always asked right off the rip, like, well, how are you going to monetize it? How are you going to make money off it? How are you going to do this? How are you going to do these things? And I said, I don't think I care. I just want to provide as much value to the industry as possible. And people will eventually realize that it's genuine and they will give back. Right. And so we've kind of always said, like, just do what's right. And, people that'll always come back to you, right? So I love that you said that. The other thing too that's interesting, right? And it's like how to look at problems and being a good communicator, but asking the right questions and learning how to learn. Daniel Hawkins has been on the podcast, and obviously, I think, you know, at this point now people have realized, you know, Avail Med Systems wasn't as big of a success, but he was like number 6 or 5 or 4 or something like that. Intuitive Surgical, and then he was the founder of Shockwave Medical, right? You know, and the CEO, yeah, and he crushed it, right? And I asked him, I said, he was with some other companies too. I mean, he's had a ton of successes, and I'm like, Daniel, I mean, surely like you can't like, there's not some secret process you're following. So where are you winning at? And he said, it's the question piece of like, when you ask someone a question and you're doing the research, you have to understand what assumptions they're making when giving you that answer. And if you can prove that assumption wrong, would it change their answer? And so it was like customer discovery and learning and that kind of thing. And that has just kind of rung true with me because so often, you know, our startups we work with go out, ask questions, and then they come back and say, well, this physician said this. And I said, great. What's the background of that physician? Why did they answer that way? Is there a reason why? Because before you go make a wholesale change on your company here, shouldn't we think about that?
Also, it's one person. So like, you gotta be careful, right? So that's the other thing to be careful of.
Yeah. And so that's important. You know, we try to always spend some time because then also we also figured out that some startups are really bad at asking questions. And so you might be asking a question and the reason you're getting that answer is because you're asking it, in a, you know, not appropriately, but it just gets back to that kind of learning aspect of things. So I love the advice you gave. We've alluded to or done a lot of foreshadowing here for the book. We actually haven't read the book name or what the book is.
Yeah. No stress.
So, it's available on Amazon. There'll be a link in the show notes. So that's clear, but it's From Here to There and it's about career transitions, right? So maybe it's on the screen for
on the screen,
most of the people are listening in. But can you just tell me again, From Here to There is the name of the book, but why you wrote it? And if someone, it's kind of self-explanatory and I think a little bit, but why would someone pick this up and read it?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think it's a great question. And I always, the reason why honestly was, I've had this conversation with so many people and I'm sure you probably are the same, Dwayne, where you meet a lot of people who are in past lives or are stuck where they are and are asking you about, hey, you know, how did you do what you did? How did you get into your career? You know, what happened? And I mean, I can't tell you the number of people over the last 4 years who have asked, like in sciences and undergrad and master's programs in medical school, people who have graduated, who are working with like, how did you get into VC and how did you do it? And to me, what I found about that is that I think a lot of people can tell you their story, which is great. And I think it's important. And that's also a big part of the book. Is my own story to tell you like, here's how I actually did it. But at the same time, it's also like steps, like concrete, actual, legitimate. These are the steps that you need to take to do this, right? Like first thing being like, how do you figure out what you want to do? You know, it sounds like a kind of common sense thing, but like, you know, what's a framework? How do you think about it? What do you need to look for? Okay. Then once you think about that, then it's like, okay, how do you set up a resume? What's good tips for setting up a resume? What's bad tips for setting up a resume? How do you set up a LinkedIn profile? Because at the end of the day, all of us are digital now and your LinkedIn and what you do digitally will be shown to people and will be looked at no matter who you're going for. Then it's like, how do you have conversations, right? Like how do you reach out? Because I've had so many conversations that are complete duds that I'm like, sometimes tell people, I'm like, wow, you are terrible at this. And then there's other times where I'm like, oh, this person's actually mindful, understands, very, you know, thing and careful. And also even for myself, where when I started reaching out to all these VCs and having all these conversations with all these folks in my life, I had some terrible ones at the beginning because we all do. I had no idea what I was doing. I had no idea what I was asking. I had no context. I didn't do any preparation. There's none of that. And then over time, I've gotten a bit better at it. And then also, and kind of goes into the other part of like, you know, the emotional journey of when you make the decision, how you feel as an individual, but how you have to deal and with questions around like family, spouses, kids, partners, friends, colleagues. Because anytime you make a transition in your life, it's a big deal. Because a lot of people, I feel like everybody likes their identity of what people perceive in another person. So like you, like I think of you, for example, as, you know, a person that works at a corporate gig. And that's where I thought about you my entire life. And so that's the only way I see you. But if you're like, well, I'm not that person, I want to be this other person, and you try and leave that, people are going to be like, wait a second, that's like, you know, that's a bit different. Like, what do you mean? Like, and to me, medicine, again, when I said I'm leaving medicine, as you can imagine, most questions from my parents is, what the hell are you doing? What are you going to do? And so to me, I think that, again, that's like a big, you know, as you can imagine, especially coming from an Indian immigrant household, you know, going through all of it and being like, hey, thanks for sending me abroad. And by the way, I don't want to do this anymore. It's a big conversation, as you can imagine. And you go through a lot of your journey. So to me, honestly, the way the book is structured is it's super short. Like, it was designed to be able to be read in an afternoon. Like, legitimately, you can pick it up and read it in one afternoon, because like, I've sent it to people and they've done the same thing. And the way the book is structured is every chapter is a step in the process with like concrete, like, how do you do this step? Like, what are best tips and tricks for the step that you're on at the time? And then the second half is like reflections of myself to my younger self as he was going through it. So like, now that I'm older, what would I tell him? What are things to remember? What are things to worry about? And again, in terms of like, you know, who to pick it up, to me, I think a lot of this is for people like, one, I think young people who are like just starting their careers. If you're in university, if you're in high school, if you're like just starting in one career, but you're not really sure if it's for you, I think it's potentially great for them. I also think it's people who are at mid-stage of their careers, right? Like, you know, you and I who have been at one place and trying to move to another, or, you know, even if it's within the same industry, like even if you're trying to move from one job to another, like, you know, I had a friend recently I spoke to who's like, you know, I'm just like kind of leaving this one firm. I'm trying to get into the same one, but I'm not really sure. And I'm like, listen, this is literally why I wrote this, because I'm like, this is perfect, because again, it was one of those things where I think like, we never, when people go through transitions, a lot of people tell you, like, I can tell you the story, right? Like, especially if you speak to, I mean, you probably had many people on this podcast who are CEOs and people who have done great things, and, you know, they tell you, and it's almost like rush through, where it's like, yeah, I've lived so long that like, you just go through it. But to me, the like individual, like, what did you do when you went from one to the other, you never really hear about, or I never really see resources online that are actually helpful for that. Because to me, that was the biggest thing. It's like, how do I give value to someone where when they're actually going through the process, they need the steps to know what they're doing. And again, it's one of those where later on in your career, you've done it once or twice, you kind of know, you have your network, you can reach out, you can do all those other things. But when you're starting, I mean, I didn't know anyone. Like, I had nowhere to go, I had no one to do. And so to me, it's more like a, how do I give, honestly, when I wrote it, it was written to myself, like as a kid. Like, it was written to me as a younger person, like, how do I give this person valuable help and resource? And so that was the genesis of the book. And that's the kind of way I think about it, is like, anybody going through any type of transition at any point in your life, I think it'd be beneficial for it, but probably definitely more geared towards kind of young people and people in the mid stages of their career.
I love it. I love the personal side too, because oftentimes you don't get that.
I've
done a few podcasts where I've kind of told my entrepreneurial journey as well. And I always try to give as much personal information as possible.
Absolutely.
Because,
oh my God,
again, I have nothing to hide, right? But also, yeah, like, it's a scary transition. No matter, it doesn't matter if you're going to be an entrepreneur or you're just transitioning to a new career, it's scary, right? And also, you know, I think to your point, you know, about, you know, people are like, oh, well, you're a doctor. Like, that's the field I associate you with. You're supposed to be corporate, that sort of thing. That's a real thing. And you,
it is.
You learn a lot about relationships you have in life. I could tell you, like, I've done a rearranging of where I have slotted people in my life based on what I've learned since starting Project MedTech. Right.
Absolutely.
It's absolutely really interesting. Yeah. It's a really,
No. And to your point, and to me, that's what's really interesting about it is, as I was writing the book, I wanted to write it as a guidebook, and the feedback that I kept getting from friends and even the publisher that I was working with was, what about your story? And like, what about the emotions that you felt? And I was like, huh, I never really considered that. But then as I've read it, and now as people have provided me feedback, they're like, that's the best part. Like, you know, like, they're like, I've connected most to the person and the individual and the story. And I think that's the thing that I've started to learn, especially this year. One of my big takeaways, and I remember I was writing a little bit about this earlier this year, and I keep going back to, which is like the power of story. And how storytelling is one of those skills in general in life, no matter what you do, especially as a CEO, but especially as a med tech person in whatever you do, how to tell a good story is so, so, so valuable. And the way that people listen to stories is connection, and it's vulnerability, and it's open, and it's honesty. And to me, with this, very similar to you, with this book, like, it's all there. Like, you can see everything. Like, I didn't hide anything. And like, I mean, I recently got, like, you know, one of the, one of the people that recently read the book that I sent it to, she was like, wow, I didn't know that you went through this. Like, it's super cool to see that. Like, that's awesome. And again, it's like people that in your life that you think they know you, but then to me, it was like written the book of like, this is so honest that they're like, I genuinely didn't know all this. Right. And to me, that also part of it makes them feel like they connect with you more, because to your point, like I was thinking about this the other day, like we're all fighting a battle nobody knows about, and everybody's struggling in their own way, and nobody's perfect, and everybody's dealing with shit no matter what. And as much as you think that people are perfect, and the CEO and the guy who's raised $100 million, and you know, the person on TV like Elon or, you know, Rogan or any podcast or celebrity, everybody is struggling. Everybody. It is universal. We all do it. But it feels like nobody talks about it or wants to talk about it. And to me at the same time, but what I feel like, especially in public, and this is honestly the genesis of wanting to do podcasts, wanting to talk to people, wanting to do everything, is like, I want to be honest. This journey is not easy. It is very hard. But guess what? Life is hard. And so you might as well try to do something for you as much as possible and, you know, learn as much as you can along the way and use the resources available to you to do the best that you can. But that doesn't mean that it's not going to be easy, because nothing is easy. But at the same time, I know like the journey that I took to get to where I am, like I feel I'm so much happier than friends of mine who are still in medicine. And at the end of the day, like to me in my life, like I want to prioritize that. And I think for a lot of people that especially feel stuck where they are, they feel like there's nowhere to go. They feel like there's no out. The point of this is to say there is, and it's hard and it takes time and you won't get there overnight, but there's genuinely a process that you can follow and get to actually get out of a place where, you know, you can be much happier. And so again, that's part of the genesis of writing the book as well.
Yeah. I love the vulnerability piece too. And again, you can, if you are more vulnerable, then other people will also be vulnerable back to you. Right. So I love it. I think that's like the important piece of sharing those stories, right? Is that hopefully, you know, someone else out there is listening going, oh, well, maybe it's not so bad. Right. Other people look at it and say, well, you're insane. Right. I mean, like I always think
of course.
That, like sometimes I tell my story and I go, if, you know, if I didn't do it, would I be sitting there going, wow, this guy's like, what's he doing?
Yeah. Nuts. Yeah. 100%. I've definitely heard that once or twice from a few folks.
Right.
It's okay. You have to, you have to accept that. You're not going to satisfy everyone. You're not supposed to.
That's right. So, all right, Anish, well, this is a great thing to end on here. So link to the book in the show notes. So depending on the platform you're listening to in on, up or down an inch, and you just click on the link, it'll take you right there. I will also have Anish's LinkedIn in the show notes as well. And Anish, you also have a website, right? Where you do
posting. I do. Yes. So I'm happy to sort of talk through a bit of that too. I'll post that in the chat as well for you, Dwayne, so if people want to take a look at that and see what's going on.
Yeah. Can you give a highlight on that?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So, and it kind of context kind of goes into a bit of the book as well. And sort of the next stage of, you know, what I want to build and what I want to do is like, you know, more of these stories, more of this information that I've learned. I just want to share with people more and more, genuinely just trying to figure out ways to do it and trying to execute on that the next little while. So I started writing basically when I left medicine 5 years ago. I originally started with a journal, just kind of to myself every day. Actually learned that on a podcast, a Tim Ferriss podcast, where I just heard so many people that were super successful always talk about writing as a medium of just like for themselves. And so started that in 2018. 2021, I kind of formally decided I wanted to write like publicly. So I started a blog. This was part of the blog. The goal at that time was to write 100 blog posts in a year. I actually wrote 500. So as you can imagine, very busy and doing a lot. And since that time, never stopped writing. And the stuff I write about is random, all over the place, related to what we're doing, not related. But what's really exciting about it to me is like I've now at the point where I haven't stopped writing. This was 2021. We're now at the end of 2023, and I've written almost 900 blog posts. And so it's been really cool. And a lot of them are nonfiction. All of them are about life and my interpretation of the world and how I see things. But the other thing with that is that on my website, I'm a big reader. So I read a lot of nonfiction because, you know, as we talked about, like just being adventurous is one of those things where I love that I get paid to learn. And to your point, I get paid to ask questions. And to me, if I can learn about other parts of society and industries and stories and biographies and all these other things, I think that helps me become a better investor. And so many years ago, again, when I left medicine, I started reading as well. And so I've now read almost 300 nonfiction books and taken notes on almost all of them. And so those are all on the website as well. And so, again, that was kind of the genesis for, you know, going through this process where, you know, I read and write every day, and then got to a point this year where I was like, you know what, I should actually do it myself. So, you know, I'm tired of, like, you know, hearing other people, why not, like, try it for me? And so that was the genesis of the book. That was kind of why I wanted to start. I actually released at the same time a poetry book, because I got really into that at the same time. So I released two books this summer. Both of them you can find on Amazon. I can send the link to Dwayne as well, so he can share that too. So yeah, you know, if people want to check out more of what I'm doing, it's going to be on the website. LinkedIn is probably the best way. I think a lot of my posting and stuff will come through there. So if you want to follow me on that, that's probably easier to find out. But yeah, the goal is to spend a lot more time on this kind of stuff over the next few years. So you'll definitely be hearing it from me, and you'll see a lot more content in coming up a little bit. So super excited about that.
Awesome, Anish. Well, I appreciate it. Hang on for 1 minute. We'll chat offline. But thanks so much for doing this, sharing your story, sharing your
thank
book,
you.
And sharing the wisdom.
Oh my God, appreciate it. Yeah, no, much appreciated. Super, super awesome. Thank you so much for the opportunity. Really, really grateful.
Thanks for listening. If you need anything from us, you can contact us at info@projectmedtech.com. And for more information on Project MedTech, visit our website at www.projectmedtech.com. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.